going to lead us in a song. Because I can. Who's going to stop me? And here I have a microphone, and I grew up singing into my father's radio, and all the other cow and Sam Anders would go, John, which one is that? Because they had eight, my parents' children, and he said, oh, that's Maria, because that's what he called me. Well, tell her to keep singing. And so I'd stand there and I'd sing into the microphone, whatever I made up. This is a song about love. And I sang it a lot while working on this and while editing this book, The Fifth Woman. You might recognize it. I might have changed it without knowing it. It goes like this. Love is something if you give it away. Give it away, give it away. Love is something if you give it away. You end up having more. It's just like a magic penny. Hold on tight and you won't have any. Love is something if you give it away. You end up having more. Okay, now you know it. So.
Love is something if you give it away, give it away, give it away. Love is something if you give it away, you end up having more. It's just like a magic penny, hold on tight and you won't have any. Love is something if you give it away, you end up having more.
Thank you. Thank you. You were great. So, I'm going to read some chapters or songs from the book. I call them songs sometimes. Look, it's a song cycle. It's really a collage. It's a novel collage. And this one is towards the beginning, and it's called Two Clean Things. There is a kind of wailing that sounds like singing. It comes from the hollow parts of the skull and from the roots of the hair and even from the thumbnails. I was living in a third floor studio apartment on a block that was said to have the highest crime rate in the city. Even on the third floor, the landlord who lived across the country had placed bars on the windows. Some of the bolts attaching them to the building had rusted and broken, and so bars were missing here and there. Whenever I left the building, I wore an oversized coat and knit watchman's cap with my hair shoved inside, so you couldn't tell I was a young woman. There was an alley off one side that the tenants unironically called Toilet Alley, and it was also useful for selling drugs and sex, dumping garbage, and occasionally, or so I had been told, for dying. I had moved into the apartment over the alley after Michelle died. I wanted to live alone. I wanted to be alone. And after 3 months of looking, I realized a place with bars on the windows and stains on the carpet was all I could afford. Across the alley stood a rooming house, and my apartment over the alley had one window that faced the alley, though I could see the main street from an angle. And for 2 hours on late afternoons, the sun blasted through. Monday through Friday, I walked up Market Street to my job and down Market Street from my job. On weekends, I worked on my literature thesis. And at night, I ate at my table and read stories and listened to the alley people's bowels and moans and whispers. There were sounds that defied language, sounds I've never heard again. There was a man I saw most days in the alley in the morning as I walked out the front door and turned right toward Market Street. He was gone in the evening. He wore a buckskin jacket and his face was lobster red and pocked with deep marks that I could see even from a distance. "Good morning," he said cheerfully every time he saw me pass. He was sitting against the building, usually, or leaning up against it. I said nothing, not because I didn't like him or had a particular attitude toward his presence there, but because the morning comes to me like a box of puzzle pieces without the box. It takes me until noon to construct any reasonable or recognizable landscape. Some days I would attempt language. I would lift my head slightly and open my mouth. He seemed to understand. He would put up one hand. Once he said, "It's all right." "Good morning," he said one morning after I'd lived there for a few months. And then he said, "Wait, wait." I stood on the street, a pair of men's underwear, so clean, it must have fallen out of someone's laundry bag, lay crumpled to the left of my foot. "Come here," he said. "Just come close enough so I can toss you something." The day was so cool. Usually I didn't notice things like that on my walk to work, but the stopping made me feel the coolness of the air. I pulled my watchman's cap down over my ears and backed up a few feet. The man crouched in the entrance of the alley, about 10 feet away from me, his back against the brick. He had one watery gray eye, tender and whale-like. I was surprised to see that the other eye was missing, but I couldn't look long enough to create a memory and describe it now, except to say there was wrinkled skin where the eye should have been. How had I missed such an injury? Later, he would tell me he had a sister in Berkeley and cousins in the city who owned a gas station. And when he was a kid and worked there, he became addicted to the fumes. He sat up and threw something, and I instinctively reached for it. It was clean, a stuffed animal, a little donkey with gray haunches and a white belly. A name was stitched into the belly with red thread. "Are you Russell?" I asked. "No. I'm Zach." There was a tree on that street, a fat, happy ficus that blew and blew in the wind, and the sun rose from behind a building and cast the tree's shadow, a thick branch, over the man so suddenly. And then a big leaf cast over and covered his red nose, and leaves rippled over his buckskin jacket, and he looked at me with his one eye, squinting in the momentary sun. "Thank you," I said. He pulled his coat up over the back of his head, making it into a shelter. And the tree, that marvelous, oblivious beast of rubbery green leaves, grew fatter over the years and is still there. The horse. One. Every day for 2 years in that apartment above the alley, I sat on the couch reading stories for my thesis, which was about animals, or rather about animals in place in contemporary literature. I was especially curious about the literary portrayal of North American farm animals. In one story, 3 Days, by Samantha Hunt, Beatrice and her younger brother decide to ride their old farm horse, Humbletonian, to the new mall complex a mile down the highway. They are drunk and it is freezing. The story mentions this several times. Beatrice and Clem saddle the horse, Humbletonian, and clomp off down the road uneventfully. They listen to the click of Humbletonian's hooves and the rush of the horse's warm pulse. When they reach the Middleland Mall, they tie the horse to a corral for carts outside Walmart, and then they go inside. But when they return, Humbletonian is gone. They search and search, and then a page later, behind Walmart, they discover at least 20 bulldozers and a gigantic hole. It is tremendous, far larger than a football field, and it is filled with water. As soon as I read the sentence about the hole of water, I knew the horse was going to drown. I set the story down and said out loud, "Oh no, the horse is going to drown." My chest tightened and I felt dread, and then an anticipatory sadness, and then dread again, though I can see now that my anxiety had begun paragraphs before, probably in the first paragraph where the protagonist is walking in darkness down the highway and passes a bloated dead raccoon. When I set the story down, the first thing I did was look at the back of my hand. I looked at my hand with its blue veins and geography of lines that I had always liked. As I've grown older, the veins and tendons have become more pronounced, like mountain ridges on a topographical map. After I looked at my hand, I went into the bathroom and cleaned the sink. And then I cleaned the bathroom floor with a washcloth. I thought about cleaning under the tub. In fact, I did not clean under that tub until I moved out 2 years later. Then I was surprised that although the floor was dusty, it was really not that dirty. After I cleaned the bathroom, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I didn't want to clean anymore, and I didn't want to talk on the phone, and I didn't want to go outside. And even though I knew the horse was going to drown, I began to feel hopeful that somehow the story would veer in another direction. The brother and sister would save the horse, or the horse would save itself. I picked up the story again. Humbletonian has climbed down into the pit and is walking across the surface of the ice that is formed there. The storyteller speculates that one of the bulldozers broke a water pipe while digging. There is a lot of water here, a reservoir's worth of drinking water, or Beatrice hopes not, frozen sewage. Humbletonian is walking across the ice, bending every now and again to lick the surface. Gross. In the next paragraphs, we read about the silver beauty of the horse and the gorgeous ice and dirt and the lovely darkness, thick like felt. And in the final sentence of those paragraphs, a jealous hole cracks open and swallows the back end of Humbletonian. She tries to clear the water to get a hoof back up on solid ice, but each clop of her foot hooves shatters what she's grabbed and pulls it under with her. The reader, along with the sister and the brother who are standing helplessly on the rim of the ice, watches the horse thrash in the cold water. And then the horse starts giving up. She falls still. Beatrice can see a lot of white in the horse's eye, as though it had been pried open. It blinks dry air once more for the last time. Humbletonian's head goes under, and all Beatrice can see are her forelegs above the barrier of the ice. Her legs kick, emptying what's inside them. It is a gruesome convulsion. I sat on the couch. I could not even look at the back of my hand. Two. After this, I walked into the bathroom again, but then I just stood there. I couldn't remember what I was going to do. I could see the horse thrashing through the ice and the water closing over its eyes, which had gone white. I could feel the constriction of sadness across my chest and in my mind. I played the scene again and again, thinking I would get used to the outcome or eventually would be able to see the horse more objectively as a metaphor or symbol. But each time I felt the pang of unfairness, and each time I felt the fear of the animal and the stupidity of the brother and sister. They were drunk. It was freezing. The sister had moved off the farm to a big city a year earlier, and it had been her idea to take the horse to the shopping complex, probably to prove a point. I went on with my day, but after a few hours I began to question the use of reading the story. I questioned the use of fiction in general. What did we gain? I also felt bad about the stories I had glorified in my thesis in which characters die, even though they die for a good reason. I thought, did not want to write about those kinds of stories anymore. Instead, I would write my own stories about everyday occurrences, like people reading things and thinking things, and stories in which the people and the animals just go on living the way we do, many of us, for a long time. Three. A few more hours after reading the story, I realized that I could stop some of my anxiety by telling myself the event did not happen. I could say, this story is not real. This did not happen. Though, of course, I knew in another part of me that things like that do happen. That story is, in fact, happening every day. 4. After I wrote the previous paragraph, I thought it should be the end, but then I thought, this isn't what I came to say either, is it? 5. My friend Chris has a beautiful horse with a white mane and coat with burgundy splotches. And he has amber eyes that glow in the darkness of the barn like the eyes of barn owls. I love barn owls. Once when I was visiting her in Minnesota, she told me that animals do not suffer or feel pain the way humans do. And she accused me of over-identifying with and even personifying animals. She said this because I had just told her a story about my brother's dog. 2 summers ago, my brother's nanny left his 2-year-old golden retriever in the back of his SUV after a lake outing. She had unpacked the kids and bags of lake stuff, but she forgot about the dog. It was a hot day. When my brother found his dead dog, he discovered that it had chewed off all the door handles. Can you see it gutted? My friend was right about my over-identification with animals. It was one of the reasons I was having a hard time writing my thesis, but also one of the reasons I had chosen the topic. She was not right about my personifying animals. I do not think animals are human, nor do I want animals to be like humans. What I love about animals is that they are not human. But I do feel bad that humans, including myself, have ruined so many things for animals. Even a cow knows when to stop eating off of a worn-out hill. 6. I ended up going for a walk through the city, but I couldn't get the horse off my mind. The white eyeballs, the front hooves in the air crashing down on the ice, the gruesome final convulsion. I couldn't get the idea out of my mind that the sister and brother could have done something to save the horse. I called my friend Chris on my new cell phone and told her the story, and even though she thought I was overreacting, she agreed that the horse could possibly have been saved. We talked about the story and about the baby coyote Chris had seen 2 weeks earlier on a bluff in southeastern Minnesota. 7. When I am old, I will walk and walk through the woods and meadows of North America. I will not bring a camera or notebook, only my eyes, my ears, my nose, and my skin. I will sleep near streams and hike up mountains. The sun will bake my skin brown and my hair white, and I will hobble like an old mountain goat. Give me my green, green grass and blue water. Give me my mineral-flavored air and rain to wash the dirt off my hooves. On my way home from my walk, I lay on a hill in a park and stared at the tops of eucalyptus, cypress, giant sequoia, redwood, madrone. I listened to the earth's dense whisper and the air's silence. All the birds were cooing or cawing. A dragonfly landed in the crease of my neck. 8. As soon as Beatrice sees Humbletonian on the ice, she runs into the store. Everything is happening in slow motion, but she keeps on going. She rallies the Walmart workers in their blue aprons that say, "Walmart, how can I help you?" Someone from Yard and Garden grabs a rope, and someone in the candy department grabs a caramel apple, and at least 20 Walmart workers follow Beatrice out the back door. The cashier from Register 3 knows a lot about ropes and horses, and she instructs the sister and brother to say encouraging things while holding out the apple. "Listen to me, Humbletonian," Beatrice says. "We are going to get you out. Don't give up. You're just resting for a moment." And that's when the woman tosses the rope over the horse's neck and slips it under her front legs and yells, "Now!" The bulldozer inches forward, and all the people line up along the rope, and everyone pulls and pulls and pulls, and their hearts race, and they feel their determination like a beast, and together they pull the goddamn horse free. Thank you.